Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we are exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. Today, we'll be discussing uveitis, both anterior and posterior. Uveitis is the general term for inflammation of the uveal tract. In other words, the iris, the ciliary body, and the choroid. Different conditions affect different parts of the eye and for different amounts of time. Uveitis can be acute, recurrent, or chronic, and it most commonly affects the iris and the ciliary body, which is what we call anterior uveitis. Posterior uveitis is less common, but it can be more significant in terms of the risk of sight loss. Most cases of uveitis do get better with treatment, but depending on where it is in the eye, it often causes pain and could cause changes to a patient's vision or ocular health, such as floaters, glaucoma, or cataracts. We'll be delving into the condition in more detail with Dr. Barlini Balasubramanian and Professor Alistair Denniston of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham.
The incidence of uveitis is estimated to be between 15 and 50 per 100,000 people per year in the UK. Given that your chances increase as you get older, uveitis is commoner than you might think. And in fact, if you look at it from the other end, in terms of how much severe sight loss does it cause, well, it probably causes about 15% of severe sight loss in the UK.
We'll hear more from Alistair and Barlini shortly. But first, we're going to start with a rarer form of posterior uveitis. To gain an insight from a patient's perspective, one of our producers, Dr. Hilary Geit, spoke to Alison.
My name's Alison Richards. I've had PIC, punctate inner choroidopathy, for about 28 years, but have only had an actual diagnosis for the last 8 years.
Let's start at the beginning. What did you first notice?
When I was 24 years old, I was on holiday reading a book and noticed a distortion on my page. I assumed it was the sun and thought, when I get back home, I need to go and get my eyes checked. I went to the opticians. They looked into my eyes, got a little bit concerned, consulted with other members of the team and sent me straight to the eye hospital.
Did you have any other symptoms like blurred vision or pain or floaters at the time?
So the way PIC presented with me at the start was wavy lines. And when I closed one eye, I did have a little bit of a flashing spinning lights, which is now a defined symptom of PIC, but it wasn't known at the time. I didn't have any floaters or other symptoms at that point.
And did you have any other underlying health conditions?
At the time, I had perfect vision and I had no underlying health conditions, so I was fit and healthy.
Right, so you went to the A&E at the hospital. What did they say about your condition?
They were a little confused at what was going on with my eye. I had, at that point, a fluorescein test and they could see that some of my capillary veins were leaking blood and pushing the retina off the eye.
Did anyone mention PIC at this stage?
No, not at all.
So what happened next?
I had two operations to deal with the retinal bleeding and to put the retina back on, which didn't work and resulted in scarring on the right eye, which led to the loss of all central vision and left me with just peripheral vision around the right eye.
You had these operations and we know now that you had PIC.
Yes. So after the operations, I must have had PIC and the PIC, I think over a period of time, burnt itself out. So I had a long period of stability. And then the year after I'd had twins, I noticed symptoms in the left eye, which were wavy lines in my vision, spinning lights and grey spots, but more opaque grey spots. So not just in the one place, they were all around the centre of my vision.
And so what happened next? Where did you go?
I went to my local eye hospital. I was seen and told that we can't see anything in your eye. You're fine. Go home. I waited 5 days. My vision deteriorated further. I went back and I was still told, no, go away. So what's very important to know about PIC patients is that when we see an eye chart, we can see round our grey spots and we can read an eye chart. This does not mean something is not going on.
When did you get the diagnosis?
When I got through to my consultant at the Queen Elizabeth, I finally got the diagnosis of PIC.
What was your vision like at this stage?
At this point, I had 1-year-old twins and I couldn't see to feed them. I couldn't see to drive and I couldn't see to read or watch telly.
So what treatment did they give you?
The treatment is twofold. For the bleeds, it's Avastin injection. I was given a steroid implant called an Ozidex. This only extended my usable sight by a couple of weeks. The turning point in my journey happened 4 years ago when I was given the Iluvium implant. This is a long release steroid implant, and that's given me my life back over the last 4 years. I'm back working, I'm driving, and I'm living my life now.
Alison, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you.
I'm now joined by Alison's team at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham, Professor Alistair Denniston and Dr. Barlini Balasubramanian. Thank you for joining me. Let's start by talking about Alison and punctate inner choroidopathy, or PIC. Alistair, how common is PIC?
So it's a rare condition. We can't give you an exact number of it, but we're probably talking in the hundreds of patients across the UK rather than, you know, many thousands. It's commoner in particularly younger, short-sighted women. And so that's the group that we tend to see it when we do see it.
And how easy is it to miss a PIC diagnosis? For example, Alison presented to A&E and they sent her away twice because they couldn't really pick up any abnormalities.
Yeah, I'm afraid this is quite common. If it presents in its severest form, there might be something that people can detect. But particularly in the era when we didn't have more sophisticated imaging techniques, when it's being seen just based on slit lamp examination alone, you're looking at the retina with a slit lamp, then it can be quite easy to miss in its early stages. So Alison's story is tragic, but it's actually not that surprising. And actually, I have a lot of sympathy that, you know, if it was in the early stages and without those imaging techniques, that it could easily be missed.
Barlini, if I can bring you in here, if you were to look at Alison's retina or that of another PIC patient in clinic using, you know, Volk fundoscopy or OCT, what would you be looking at?
So first of all, I guess on a colour fundus photo or just a slit lamp examination by an optician, you're looking for sort of well circumscribed yellow-grey lesions at the level of the pigmented layer, the RPE. You might see small neurosensory retinal detachments. And if they do an ultra-wide field or autofluorescent imaging, then they might see hypo and hyperautofluorescent changes. On a density map or OCT, ocular coherence tomography, you might see these sort of volcano-shaped lesions due to breaks in the choroidal junction, the basement membrane between the retinal pigment epithelium and the choroid.
And would the lesions be spaced around the retina, or would they be located in a particular area or more in the periphery?
It's often in the mid-periphery in some patients, but it can also be in the macula. And often if it's more central in the macula, that's when patients may notice sort of reduction in vision. But if they're not in the central vision axis, then they might notice sort of scotomas or blind spots in their vision.
So Alistair, why is it important that a diagnosis is made quite early?
So it's important because this is a sight-threatening condition and actually we can treat it well. But what has changed is that we've gone from this being a condition that we couldn't do anything about to being one that we can most definitely treat. But time is retina. And if you're slow to start treatment, then you are likely to lose vision.
And in the interview, Hilary, one of the other producers, she asked Alison if she had any underlying health conditions, and she didn't. But why is this quite important for uveitis?
So that's really interesting point. A lot of uveitis is associated with underlying health conditions, and PIC is a form of uveitis. But you're right. So PIC isn't associated with an underlying systemic disease. The key association we see with PIC is it tends to be in myopic younger women. But as a group, then with uveitis, we are always looking just to check and rule out that there's not an underlying systemic disease.
And in a situation like Alison's, where perhaps the retinal signs were quite subtle, how can we avoid this problem again in the future where a patient can potentially be undiagnosed or remain undiagnosed for a long time?
Well, I think there are two things I'd say here. The first thing is to really listen to the patient and be very, very wary. And I don't mean this just for PIC, I mean just for every condition. But if a patient has noticed a change in their vision, take that very seriously. And just because we can't see something, you can't dismiss it. You've just got to keep a very open mind on this and use whatever tools we have. And the second thing is the tools have changed. They've become much more sophisticated. So, you know, as Barlini said, the advent of imaging techniques, particularly OCT and autofluorescence, is brilliant at picking up the early signs of PIC. So I'm absolutely sure that if we'd had those techniques and if the optometrist who saw Alison many years ago had had those techniques, that they would have been able to pick it up. And so now we are able to detect those much more quickly. But if you didn't have those techniques available, as somebody who presents with a story like Alison's, it'd be important to refer them in to somewhere that could do those investigations to check.
As hospital eye services get busier, particularly with the NHS backlog, Barlini, how can optometrists make sure that they are only making necessary referrals and referring to the correct department?
As Professor Denniston mentioned earlier, it's important for them to listen to the patient because a lot of the clues may be actually in the history from the patient. And patients like Alison may describe certain symptoms, and I think that would be the first thing. They may describe blind spots or darkening of their central vision. Shimmering is often described. They may say there's increased floaters or light sensitivity or distortion in their vision. So all these may be clues. The age of the patient, their history, you know, are they quite short-sighted, for example? That might be a clue. And I think the next thing after listening to the patients, it would be to look for the signs. That can be done with the naked eye, with the slit lamp examination, and to dilate the pupil and look at the back of the eye, which is where you'd find the lesions. And I think a lot of opticians now also have access to imaging techniques, including photography and OCT. And that would then help them to differentiate inflammatory causes of inflammation to something they may see more routinely, such as age-related macular problems like macular degeneration.
What I always tell trainee optometrists is that if the patient comes in with a symptom that you can't explain by the end of your examination, then you really need to be referring on to somebody who can. And I think that's really important. Alison also talked about various treatments. So Barlini, what are they and how effective are they for PIC or even for other types of posterior uveitis?
So as Alison said, there's twofold. The treatments that we use to reduce inflammation in the eye, and often we may start off with steroid tablets such as prednisolone. We'd move on to other immunomodulatory medications, but these would require blood screening, investigations, and monitoring routinely. And so this is often done in the hospital eye service. And there are quite a large number of different immunomodulatory drugs which are used in the hospital setting. There are also biologic medications which have been licensed for uveitis, which we use. And then, of course, the complications of punctate inocoridopathy can include new vessel growth and leakage within the retinal layer or below. And in those situations, we'd have to treat with intravitreal treatments such as anti-VEGF or vascular endothelial growth factor treatments, which we would do in the hospital setting.
And what are the risks with large amounts of treatments like these?
Despite treatment, there is a risk of scar formation, which can lead to sort of irreversible vision loss. But that's exactly why it's important to diagnose these conditions within good time and so that we can prevent the long-term complications from occurring.
Alistair, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
I think one of the things to note is that there's really two components to the disease, which is highlighted by Barlini's point about there being two aspects of treatment. So there's the inflammatory spots, and then there's the downstream consequences of the choroidal neovascular membrane. So the neovascularization or the new vessels we see in PIC are much more like wet macular degeneration neovascular AMD than they are to something like proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So if you're seeing something that looks a bit like wet macular degeneration in a younger patient, then you're very likely that you're looking at PIC. And it may be quite asymmetric, so that some people definitely get it in both eyes, but some people get it predominantly or even exclusively in one eye.
Being able to diagnose patients effectively in optometry practice could make a real difference, couldn't it?
Yeah, so optometrists have a key role actually in saving sight in this context in a way that before we didn't have such effective treatments. It wasn't such an issue, but these newer treatments, as Barlini said, are quite concentrated steroids. The biggest risk is that pushes the pressure up. Patients won't notice that. They'll be very pleased that their uveitis is under control, so they're feeling fine, but actually they're starting to run into pressure-related damage. So if you in the community can see these patients, do check the pressure because you may save their sight.
Thank you very much. And we'll move on to anterior uveitis in just a moment. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And to help us guide our future content, we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover or have a fascinating case you want to share, email us. The address is podcast@docket.info or you can tweet us @soundoptometry. Today, we're exploring uveitis with Professor Alistair Denniston and Dr. Barlini Balasubramanian from the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. Alistair, we just talked about posterior uveitis and quite a rare form of it called PIC. But optometrists are much more likely to see anterior uveitis in their day-to-day practice. What are the telltale signs of anterior uveitis?
Anterior uveitis is the commonest form of uveitis. And anterior uveitis is primarily focused around the iris and ciliary body. And so therefore, the symptoms and signs relate to those structures of the eye. And the classic presentation is of a person who's got a painful photophobic eye. They're highly light sensitive. And if you examine it, you will see it's red, but it's not diffusely pinky red like a conjunctivitis. The vessels will be quite engorged, and it's classically a circumlimbal injection, they say. So it's quite a discrete area. And then on the slit lamp, the telltale sign is inflammation in the anterior chamber. So anterior chamber cells, which you can see and can count on the slit lamp, and anterior chamber flare, that familiar view that looks like you're looking at a sort of smoke in a projector light. Then, as you know, there are a number of additional signs like keratic precipitates, inflammatory cells just plastered on the inner surface of the cornea. And then you can start to see when it's been there for a while, you can start to see posterior synecae, so areas where the iris has stuck down onto the lens. And there are a number of other signs, but those are the key ones that we really look for.
If a patient has these signs or symptoms, could it be sight-threatening?
So many patients who get anterior uveitis have this period of painful light sensitivity, a red eye. They start on topical steroids and it quickly resolves without any long-term problems. But the problem becomes where they start to develop chronic changes from those acute inflammatory episodes. And particularly the thing that ophthalmologists look for is signs of posterior synecae. But what's harder to see, unless you do gonioscopy, is where the iris is beginning to stick down in the periphery and is starting to block up the angle. And why does that matter? Well, it matters because that's a sure way to start developing glaucoma. If we zip up the angle, the pressure starts to go up and then we get long-term damage. So in fact, for anterior uveitis, although there are other potential causes of sight loss, the thing that I worry about most is the risk of developing glaucoma if we don't control it in its early stages. But there are other ways that anterior uveitis can affect your sight, both acutely, uncommonly, but it can sometimes be associated with cystoid macular edema. And the other thing is over time, recurrent bouts of inflammation in the eye for any cause can cause cataract. That's the one I worry about least because We're good at sorting that out. But glaucoma is the thing that I always worry about in a uveitis clinic.
So optometrists really should be looking at intraocular pressure as well when a patient has these signs or symptoms.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a critical examination.
Barlini, what are the key things to look out for if you suspect uveitis in a patient?
Start systematically. So I would start from the front of the eye because following the path of light can give us clues. I would start with looking at the back of the cornea, the endothelium, to look for deposits, and then moving into the anterior chamber. We've already mentioned AC activity or cellular activity or flare, and then looking for deposits within the front of the eye, for example, posterior synechiae, where the iris is sticking to the lens, or iris atrophy. That could give us some clues as well. And then sometimes you have a certain type of cataract formation or clouding of the lens that can also give us a clue to the condition. And then moving to the posterior aspect of the eye, the vitreous chamber, so looking for pigment or cellular activity. So we're looking at vitritis. And then looking at the back of the eye, we would examine the optic nerve and the branching vessels, examine the macula to look for any signs of hemorrhages or any lesions. And then looking at the blood vessels themselves, looking to the posterior periphery to look for any signs of vasculitis. So again, there are some classic signs that you see with certain conditions, but there can be some similar signs seen for a number of conditions. So we still need to do further investigations usually.
So when you're looking at KPs, how do you know if they're old KPs or new ones?
That's a good sign. Sometimes you can't tell the difference. It's not.
So it's not just me then?
But the type of KPs that you get can give us clues. So, for example, in a common systemic condition called sarcoidosis, you might see granulomatous KPs. But in these conditions, often when you commence treatment, they can melt away. But if they're persisting, then you might think, well, what else could be going on here? It could be recurrence. It could be old activity. But if there's no AC activity and there's no other anterior chamber signs, then it could suggest that this is old. Beyond the KPs, really.
And you mentioned cataract as well. So would you expect someone to have lens changes that early on in their episode of uveitis, or would it only come on with prolonged inflammation?
So there are certain conditions such as Fuchs heterochromic iridocyclitis where you can get posterior subcapsular cataracts. So that's what I meant by certain uveitic conditions where you have inflammation, but you can get characteristic type of cataract. But of course, the treatment we provide can also lead to cataract.
And just moving on to vitritis, I mean, when I look at the vitreous, and I'm no expert looking at the vitreous, but it's very rarely transparent. Anyway, there's always bits floating in it from, you know, cinereses and so on. So what does vitritis actually look like?
So in the anterior vitreous, so if you just look in the slit lamp without any extra lens or anything, just behind the lens, that's where you'll see the individual cells. And they can look pretty similar to anterior chamber cells in the anterior chamber. They just don't move around so much, but the vitreous being a gel, they're a bit more solid. But you'll see them reflecting like tiny dots. You would struggle to see individual cells looking at the back with a Volk lens or similar. But what you do see, unlike the cinereses, which is kind of, as you say, bits floating around, if there's a diffuse vitritis, you get vitreous haze, which is basically the equivalent of anterior chamber flare, but in the vitreous. And again, it's just the same. It's protein from the inflammatory process leaking into the vitreous and making it cloudy. And you will see that there's a kind of diffuse haze. And so the clarity of the optic disc, you'll start to lose that. And actually, if it's really bad, you can't even see the disc, or it'll be very hazy. It'll be like just a headlight in the fog. And then eventually you can't see it at all.
And Barlini, what are the risk factors for anterior uveitis? Are they any different to the ones that we've already discussed when we were looking at Pick and Allison's case?
So that's a good question again. I think there are some conditions that are more commonly associated with anterior uveitis. And so if patients have recurrent anterior uveitis, we do then do specific testing for conditions such as ankylosing spondylitis associated with anterior uveitis. So we would check for a blood marker called HLA-B27. But any of the uveitis conditions that affect the back of the eye can also affect the front. Another condition that may be more associated with front of the eye inflammation can include anterior scleritis, for example, could be patients with joint problems, such as rheumatoid, where they can develop scleritis or often associated with it. So it's important to ask the patients about history of rashes, any joint pain. So those are the common conditions that we would think about.
And we covered the treatments for posterior uveitis before, but what would the typical treatment for anterior uveitis be?
So the typical treatment for anterior uveitis would be topical steroids. We commonly use things like dexamethasone 0.1%, prednisolone acetate 1%, and actually in severe attacks, you might use that even hourly, and then titrating down over, say, 6 weeks, something like that, depending on severity. And you adjust that patient by patient, really. In parallel to that, it's important to use a dilating drop, a mydriatic, something like cyclopentolate, maybe two or three times a day. You might only need that for a week or two until the inflammation is sufficiently well under control. But what we're trying to prevent with the mydriatic is preventing the synecdoche forming.
So if an optometrist does suspect uveitis and they're not in a position to manage it in their practice, where do you think the optometrist should refer to first?
I think depending on the region they're in, there should be a hospital eye service close to them that they can refer to. If it's an acute inflammation, then I would say the hospital eye casualty would be the first place to refer to. But if they find there's something more posterior going on, it would be worth referring to the retinal specialist if that's the case, and then they can direct. Not every hospital may have a uveitis specialist, but they can also directly refer to the nearest hospital that has a uveitis service.
Oh, so that's useful to know. So what would make a referral more urgent?
If you detect sight loss or there's any abnormalities near the macula, then that's an urgent referral, or even that's a straight to casualty referral.
And is there any particular information that you want from the optometrist when they refer?
Just the pertinent sort of symptoms and signs and any history that might help. But if they're not sure, I think whatever they can find out from the patient, they can put that on. I think that would be fine.
Professor Alistair Denniston, Dr. Balini Balasubramanian, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like more information on uveitis, go to our website, docit.info, and search for sound optometry to check out the additional reading materials. As part of these materials, we've also included an image of Alison's eye, which is a good example of what PIC looks like. Don't forget that by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point, covering the GOC domains of communication and clinical practice. We'll be taking a short break for the summer now, but we'll be back in September to explore corneal and ocular surface disease in children. Until then, we'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.